7BR Part Heard.
Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. This week, I'm joined by Ross Beaton to discuss what a COVID-19 inquiry might look like and some of the questions that arise when trying to imagine an inquiry of the nature and scale that any scrutiny of the handling of the pandemic would likely demand. Ross specialises in personal injury, clinical negligence and inquests. In 2019, he was instructed as a junior on the undercover policing inquiry for the Metropolitan Police Service. He also acts in commercial matters and employment disputes, and in addition to his busy paperwork practice, Ross is regularly instructed to act in trials and applications in courts across England. Hi Ross, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Perhaps the obvious question to start with is, will there be a COVID inquiry?
Well, I think we've expected there to be some sort of COVID inquiry for a while. I think it's become increasingly clear that there will now be one. There has been a lot of parliamentary activity over recent days, particularly we've seen Chief Medical Officer, Chief Scientific Officer, the Health Secretary, various other leading politicians and NHS officials appearing in front of parliamentary committees just before recess. And again, just before recess, I think the Prime Minister confirmed in a parliamentary answer that there would be a COVID inquiry, I think is what he said. He hasn't set out any details, so far as I'm aware yet, of what the inquiry might look like. But I think we would all be surprised at this stage if there wasn't some sort of inquiry, probably in quite a big scale.
And before we discuss what that inquiry might look like, in the Chief Coroner's guidance that was published in April, it was stated that an inquest would not be a satisfactory means of deciding whether adequate general policies and arrangements were in place for provision of PPE to healthcare workers because, quote, an inquest is not the right forum for addressing concerns about high-level government or public policy. And now that was updated at the beginning of this month to say that an inquest is not usually the right forum. But perhaps you could explain a bit about that relationship between inquests and inquiries, particularly in the COVID context.
Well, yes, that guidance has caused an awful lot of controversy in the legal world. And it wasn't a coincidence that it was updated. There were substantial concerns raised by a lot of lawyers who conventionally represent claimants that effectively the Chief Coroner, by issuing that guidance, was tending to rule out or encourage local coroners to rule out of scope issues which they might legitimately be concerned about. Fundamentally, a coroner's inquest has got to investigate the issues which are relevant to the death. It's classic questions. Who was the deceased? When did they die? Where did they die? And how did they die? How has got to be sufficiently wide in terms of the scope of the inquest to allay the matters of concern. So it wouldn't be good enough, for instance, to say the person died of COVID-19, full stop, if a death had occurred, for instance, in a care home where there was reason to think, some substantial reason to think, as opposed to speculation probably, that COVID precautions hadn't been properly taken care of. Similarly, if the deceased had contracted COVID at work, or there was good reason to think that they had, say there had been a COVID cluster at work, is that then an industrial disease? Probably it is, depending on the facts. The scope then has to be wider and it has to include those issues. So that's how coroner's inquests work up and down the country. And I think a lot of people were concerned that the guidance in its original form tended to rule those issues automatically out of scope. Now, of course, the Chief Coroner is not in a position to dictate to individual coroners. Individual coroners have got to make their own decisions. And people who don't like those decisions can challenge them if they wish by way of judicial review. But it's only fair to say that the Chief Coroner is there for a reason. The Chief Coroner actually sits on a lot of the judicial reviews that are brought against individual local coroners whenever they occur. So it's fair to say that guidance would have had a lot of weight and could have ruled issues out of scope, which should have been in. That's even before we get on to talking about Article 2 and the requirements of Article 2, which may mean that inquests have to have an even broader scope than they ordinarily would. And one could see how Article 2 issues could come up in the COVID context. This is about how state authorities responded to a major public health emergency. So, yes, the guidance and the controversy around that has been a starting point, perhaps, for thinking about the public inquiry. Chief Coroner is absolutely right to say that an inquest may not be the best forum to consider these issues, because you'd get a very piecemeal approach across the country and it would be a very resource heavy way of looking at them. But an inquest is only not the right forum to look at these issues if there is another better forum to look at them instead. And so that, I think, is the lens through which we have to think about any COVID public inquiry.
And if that inquiry is the better forum, what might we expect that to look like? Would it be judge-led, do you think, under the Inquiries Act?
Yes, I think it probably would. So as unpacking that, there are a couple of different types of inquiry, well, several different types that you could think of. So one type which comes to mind has been the Westminster Bridge inquests or the Hillsborough inquests. So those aren't, strictly speaking, public inquiries at all. Those are coroner's inquests where a senior coroner will be appointed, so somebody who's very experienced, likely to have staff appointed who are, you know, many individual coroners will be assisted by one part-time police officer and maybe a secretary from the local authority. They run very small organisations. And so some of these big controversial inquests, they've staffed them up in a big way and appointed senior coroners to run them. Those are still inquests, but they consider several deaths instead of one. I think in something like COVID, where, of course, there are issues to consider other than deaths, there will be people who have been left seriously ill as a result of COVID. There will be people who have been left seriously ill, having never actually had COVID, as a result of delays to their medical treatment that they were supposed to have and couldn't have for a period of months. So one thinks of, you know, patients on chemotherapy, for instance, sort of treatment has to happen regularly. One thinks of mental health patients. Just looking at it in terms of an inquest, looking at it in terms of deaths, maybe understates the problem that we have to consider here. So the other way of doing public inquiries is you have a choice between non-statutory and statutory. Non-statutory inquiries are very frequently used. They bring with them greater control over the process for the department which is establishing them or the organisation which is establishing them, which means for that organisation, they can control the scope, they can control the cost, which is often important to them, they can control the speed to try and get on with it, etc. And we've seen non-statutory inquiries used, for instance, into, there was a cluster of deaths at Gosport Hospital is one that comes to mind, which was investigated by a non-statutory inquiry. So not necessarily led by a judge, potentially, I can't remember how it worked in that individual Gosport case, but potentially you have somebody from an individual NHS trust appointing somebody from a different trust to conduct an inquiry into them. So those can have the advantages of speed and not being expensive, but the disadvantages of not actually being independent, not being seen to be independent, and not fulfilling the same functions as an inquest would. So I think for all of those reasons, that probably is ruled out for a COVID inquiry. The other way of going is under the Inquiries Act, which is an act that was brought in 2005, designed to build on some very big public inquiries which had run up to then. So the Bloody Sunday inquiry being a key example, where a lot of money had been invested. Some very, very senior judges had been involved and led those inquiries, but the inquiries had gone on for a very long time. And so the idea was, is there anything that we can learn from previous inquiries about how we set the terms of reference, how we set the scope, how we appoint the chair, how we appoint the staff, to make inquiries consistent? Part of the idea back in 2004, 2005 was that there would be some sort of inquiries service, even, which would be a consistent body, independent of government across the country, that would run public inquiries. That never really happened. So you've got all these ad hoc inquiries, but they're set up under the same act and they tend to have similar processes. Now, the advantage of doing something under the Inquiries Act is that you have a chair who's independent or a panel who are independent. You draw on the experience of other inquiries. You appoint a secretariat from the senior civil service who support the inquiry. And they're appointed in such a way that they work for the chair so that they are independent too of central government. And from the point of view of achieving consistency and avoiding there being tens of thousands of inquests as there otherwise may have to be across the country into the effect of investigating the same issues over and over again, there are provisions in the Inquiries Act and in the Coroners and Justice Act whereby if there's a public inquiry into the same fact as an inquest under the Inquiries Act, the inquest basically stops, is the simplest way to put it. They open the inquest, but then they stop it. And it only resumes if the public inquiry, for any reason, doesn't investigate that death. Otherwise, the public inquiry performs the role of what the local coroner would have done, takes over those functions, and so then you don't have an inquest. So I think that's the most likely way forward. I suppose there's one final alternative to have in mind, which is the government have a majority. They put through the Coronavirus Act to deal with these unprecedented circumstances. It's conceivable they could put through a Coronavirus Inquiry Act or seek to do that, which would set up something entirely new that we haven't seen before. I think certainly we will see some sort of arrangements that we haven't seen before in response to what's a completely unprecedented situation. But the difficulty, it seems to me, with doing that is that if they don't ape the provisions of the Inquiries Act, people will inevitably say, why are you doing less? And the system under the Inquiries Act, whereby you don't get inquests taking place at a local level, duplicating or perhaps contradicting the finding of the large public inquiry, if that was implemented in a new act, taking away power from coroners whilst investigating less than the Inquiries Act inquiries would normally investigate, I think politically that would be very difficult. And I think it could lead to difficulties at the European Court of Human Rights level around Article 2 challenges as well.
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine that being very well received. In terms of those sort of political sensitivities, are there potential sensitivities around investigating serving ministers and their decisions, which necessarily would be a significant part of the inquiry?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've seen that sort of question asked quite a lot in the news recently. It's not just serving ministers, it's advisors to those ministers as well. Yes, of course, there are political sensitivities around those sorts of things. It would be silly to try and say otherwise, but there's plenty of scope for this happening. It's what public inquiries do. If you look at, for instance, the Chilcot inquiry, that was a major inquiry into the Iraq War. The Iraq War, of course, was something which happened under a Labour government. The Chilcot inquiry was set up under the Labour government. And the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, gave evidence on, I think, more than one occasion to the Chilcot inquiry and was criticised to a certain extent. There are other inquiries that one can think of, the Hutton inquiry into matters arising out of the Iraq War that happened even before that. Closer to my home, Northern Ireland, we've seen a scandal that most people in England have probably never even heard of, called the Renewable Heat Initiative scandal. And that was a big deal in Northern Ireland. Effectively, it was around waste of public money, or alleged waste of public money from a badly put together policy. Some people alleged a corrupt policy. And it led to the collapse of the government in Northern Ireland, and Northern Ireland being without a government for, I can't remember exactly how long it was, but 3 years. It set a record for being without a government for a modern developed state. And a public inquiry was set up, led by a retired High Court judge with a senior English Home Office civil servant and a senior energy expert on the panel. They were given powers to compel disclosure, not just from the Northern Ireland Civil Service, but from ministers individually, from political parties, from their advisors. They were looking at WhatsApps and individual advisors' phones and things like that. They used their powers to the fullest extent. Was it embarrassing? I'm sure it was for many of the people involved. But the point is that it happened, and that only recently reported. So it could actually, if I was a civil servant tasked with designing a large-scale COVID public inquiry, that's one of the ones that I would look at, actually. Probably small beer in the context of the whole of the UK, but it was a massive deal in the context of a very small jurisdiction. So it might be a reasonable model to look at as a comparison.
It's clear that any COVID inquiry definitely has the potential to be quite a mammoth exercise. How have other big inquiries worked in the past?
Well, I think part of the answer to that is that some of them have been quite slow and have been perceived to have got out of hand in terms of costs. The Bloody Sunday inquiry is the one that I mentioned earlier, took, I think, over a decade to report. Now, the report was very thorough when it did come out, but the mere fact, and many people in Northern Ireland would have said that it was worth the wait. Others may disagree with that. But the very fact of the amount of time that was taken isn't just a problem in terms of cost. It's a problem in terms of people who wanted the inquiries. Some of them would have been very elderly, never lived to see the report. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's an example of a public inquiry working badly, but it's an example of something having been tried that hadn't been tried before on a massive scale, and lessons needing to be learnt thereafter in terms of what systems you build, how you use electronic document disclosure, how you manage your systems better, how you staff it, etc., and designing the scope of the inquiry, so the terms of reference and keeping them tight. So that's an example that we would learn from in terms of doing things differently. We've seen the Chilcot inquiry. Some of the same points could be made about the Chilcot inquiry. Obviously, it was a very big issue, but it took a long time. I mentioned the Westminster Bridge as being an alternative example. That's been quite quick, actually. Those events were not all that long ago, and the hearings have been got on very quickly. The issues have been kept relatively narrow, and it seems to me, looking at it from the outside, that appropriate staffing was put in place to get the inquiry underway and get a thorough result in a reasonable period of time. Now, I suppose one thing which comes to mind with the COVID inquiry that maybe isn't the same with some other areas of life is that, of course, this is an ongoing health crisis. We've seen spikes in other countries. We've seen, it seems, virtually every country in Europe that we've looked at opening up travel to into England that have had to be continually reviewed in terms of local spikes. Does the advice that was given out 2 or 3 weeks ago about it being safe to travel to those countries still apply? We've seen similar things in Leicester, where there was lockdown, then there wasn't lockdown, then there was lockdown again. So definitely that there will be some lessons that we'll want to learn very quickly. And there's precedent for doing that too. So having some sort of early, quick, probably technical inquiry running alongside or separately from the major public inquiry. So it wouldn't be hard to see how that would happen in a case like this.
Finally, then, Ross, and that sort of leads me to this question, at least for this episode. I know it's early days, but I was wondering what you think the likely terms of reference are and whether a COVID inquiry would be suited to a multiple stage sort of framework.
Well, Ellie, I think that's almost a question for another entire episode, which I think we might do quite soon, hopefully. Setting the terms of reference really is key. It's something you do at the start of the inquiry. Designing the inquiry properly is essential to getting a good result in and following a thorough investigation in a reasonable period of time. Where you see the terms of reference drawn too widely, that can lead to inquiries going on for years and decades, and one can think in some cases of inquiries that may never report. So getting the right is key. What sort of things would be in there? Well, there are some things that would have to be in there. So the UK will be mindful of its Article 2 obligations. What we won't want to see is families bringing challenges under Article 2 to the Strasbourg court, saying the deaths of our loved ones have not been properly investigated. So there's a sort of a minimum standard to satisfy the Inquiries Act provisions around stopping there needing to be a duplication of inquests, duplication of investigations across the country. Inquiry would need to look at who, where, when, how, for essentially every individual who died of COVID. One could think separately what to do about those individuals who may have died of COVID, but we don't know because the testing wasn't available at the time. So I think that would be an issue that would be dealt with in some way. Those who may have died as a result of the knock-on effects of the lockdown and the things which we had to do to stop COVID from spreading. Obviously, we saw this massive spike in deaths, about 50 or 60,000 deaths during the period March through to late May, middle of June, over and above the deaths which we'd normally see at those times of the year. Effectively, all of those in some way are going to have to come within the scope of this inquiry. How we achieve that, I think, really probably does need another episode. Then looking beyond that, the sort of questions of what did we know, when did we know it, what ought we to have known, what should have happened, should things have been done in early March that were not done until late March, if they had been, what difference would that have made, etc. Those sorts of issues, I think, are likely to fall within the terms of reference as well. But it's important to remember that that sort of thing makes the inquiry much bigger, much harder, potentially much longer, much more expensive. Every line you add to the terms of reference could increase the length of the inquiry substantially, increase the cost of the inquiry substantially. Every line you cut from the terms of reference could reduce public confidence in the inquiry and could lead to families of the deceased feeling that they've been shortchanged. So it's going to be the center of political controversy, I would expect, in months to come. Maybe the center of another episode that we do, I don't know.
It's clear that deciding those terms of reference is going to be a delicate balance, and there is still plenty to discuss. So I'm sure we'll get the opportunity to do that in a follow-up episode. But for now, Ross, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to 7BR's Part Heard. It remains to be seen how exactly the inquiry will be set up, who will chair it, who will the core participants be, and of course, what will those terms of reference be? We'll be discussing all of the above in part two of this COVID-19 inquiry episode, coming soon.